Hello, and thank you for joining our podcast. My name is Stephanie Jarris, and I'm the Director of Research for the Department of Defense Counter Insider Threat Program. Voices from the SBS Summit is a monthly podcast brought to you by the Threat Lab, DoD's Counter Insider Threat Program, and the National Insider Threat Task Force. This podcast features conversations with presenters from the Threat Lab's annual Counter Insider Threat Social and Behavioral Science Summit. We'll ask guests about what's new since September's summit, including updates to their presentations, what they didn't have time to talk about, and what they think about what's going on right now. This week, David Prina, a political scientist with the Threat Lab, is talking to Lynn Van Mail about promoting post-event organizational and individual resilience. Enjoy the episode.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Voices from the SBS Summit, a podcast brought to you by the Threat Lab. I'm David Prina, and today we are talking to Lynn Van Mail about promoting post-event organizational and individual resilience.
Thank you very much for being here.
Oh, you're most welcome. Thank you for the invitation to join you today.
Of course, of course. Let's just go ahead and dive right in.
Sure.
So
your summit talk focused on post-event organizational and individual resilience, which includes rebuilding trust between personnel and the organization after an incident. In your talk, you discussed how organizations might expect to lose employees during the disillusionment phase of Zunin and Meyer's model before trust is rebuilt. Can you talk about the process of transitioning out of a high-stakes or immediate post-event environment and how an organization can support transitioning employees?
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for that opportunity to clarify. I think the Zunin and Meyer's model is really helpful for us to consider the phases that an organization might go through. It was a model that was developed for communities following tragic and high impact events. And when we take a look at a community of a workplace, an organization, an administration, a unit, we can see some of the same kinds of events occurring. So for example, the disillusionment phase is in stark contrast to the honeymoon phase that directly precedes it. During the disillusionment phase, communities, cultures, groups of people, and individuals start to realize the limitations of the assistance they've been receiving, the instant rally of support, and their optimism that things are going to turn out okay and resolve starts to wane. People get discouraged, and that stress continues to take a toll as we see negative reactions, physical exhaustion, sometimes poor coping strategies like substance use or abuse may actually start to surface during disillusionment. This increasing gap between the need for assistance and the feeling that there's not enough assistance can start to feel like abandonment. And as the larger community and other people start to return to, quote, business as usual, if there's any work group or workplace or individual that still is lingering in a place of needing more support, they can really start to self-judge and to feel disillusioned. This phase can last, months, perhaps even years. So it's not as if people move quickly through disillusionment, and it can have little ups and down moments, especially those that might be triggered or brought on by anniversary events or the things that might come up that are reminders, like if maybe there's a court date that's associated with the apprehension of someone who was involved with creating the trauma, or if there's, like I said, the anniversary date, those can really trigger increased feelings of disillusionment as well.
And can you talk about what employees need to be aware of when transitioning out of a high-stakes environment? What are the risks to keep in mind for these transitioning employees?
Nice question. Thank you. For those of us in leadership roles, as people who are in that disillusionment phase decide to leave the organization or to transition out of an immediate environment or perhaps out of our organization altogether, I think it's really important for us to remember a simple two words. Thank you. Thank you for what you've done, for what you've contributed. See that you're moving out of this area or out of this region or perhaps out of our company, out of our service, but we appreciate what you have given and recognize that the last fill in the blank 2 weeks, 2 months, 3 years have not been easy.
and that you would want to acknowledge the impact of that critical event, and that it's a long process. And we hope that whatever the choices are that you're making right now, with respect to your transitioning away from this organization right now, that those are in support of your continued rebuilding and your continued healing following this kind of a traumatic experience or a critical event. If it's appropriate to send the employee forward with any kind of a positive separation package, if they're leaving the organization altogether, like, you know, extend their medical or mental health benefits, maybe you can do a salary buyout of any unused leave or any kind of HR bonus to help them land well as they leave. Even perhaps if they're staying with you, a relocation bonus or helping them move. That could be really appreciated and shown as a sign of good faith as recognizing the impact of the event and rebuilding trust.
You talked about the organizational response, but what sort of considerations might you have for employees, or what might be going through an employee's head during the transition?
Absolutely. Obviously, as an individual who decides it's time to move on, that this isn't working, maybe I'm in the disillusionment phase myself personally, and I need to do what's right for me, for my personal life, for my situation, for my professional career following this kind of an experience. I think it's important for individuals to remember that leaving is a personal decision that's usually made to support health and healing and growth. And it's not, quote, you know, like cowardly or isn't a selfish bailout. I think a lot of us hold this idea that when the going gets tough, the tough get going. And that's what the honeymoon phase is about, is the tough to get going. And the tough can burn out and the tough can deplete. And the tough can get stuck in a place where they aren't going to heal or get better and only entrench. And when we get into those places, the tough need to know when it's time to say enough. And for people not to judge themselves and to really take a moment to reflect on what closure might mean to you as an individual or as a person. In this transition, as I leave, what would be important for me to have as closure so I can let this go and move on? Those are difficult questions to ask. People face them whenever they do any kind of a transition. And when the transition is away from something that caused a lot of pain or impact, it can be especially complex.
When it comes to leadership, you note that it is important for leaders to be present and active in supporting their employees. Can you talk more about what employees should do if they feel their leadership is not meaningfully invested in their organization or employees?
That's another really good question. Thank you for asking it. It's difficult to know exactly what employees want that would be meaningful manifestations of investment. So if as an employee, I'm experiencing that my organization isn't showing me that they care or that they aren't doing things in a way that makes sense to me to say they're rebuilding trust, it'd be really nice for me to sit down and say, what exactly is it that I'm expecting? What is it in as behaviorally specific a term as possible? What exactly would I as an employee want to see, want to experience, want to hear from my leadership that would let me know that they are meaningfully invested in the organization and their employees? Like, what would it take? What would it look like? And then once I get clear on what that would be, like really what's the ask and what is it that I am expecting that I'm not getting that's leaving me in the lurch, then it's time to figure out the best way to communicate that to leadership. And it might be that I could invite some trusted colleagues or coworkers who also experienced the critical event to brainstorm some tangible ways that leaders could be more meaningfully invested in supporting employees. That might not be just my opinion, but other people's opinions. And in sharing ideas, we might come up with better solutions than I would have come up with myself. And then I might want to think about the context of my organization and its culture when I approach leaders for feedback. How would I do that? Is there already an expectation of follow a chain of command? Or is my organization a little more, if you will, flat in its organizational structure that I can, from wherever I am on the org chart, approach senior leaders? Who's the best person to do that? Am I the best person, or is there someone else in my work group, maybe a direct supervisor or another colleague who upwardly manages really well, and maybe the messaging might come best from them? Is there a public forum that leadership has provided that allows me to have these conversations and give direct feedback, or is it best done through an anonymous survey? So these are all kinds of things I would want to consider as an employee when if I'm feeling the need to speak up that my organization maybe is falling short of my expectations. How am I going to remedy that? Are there existing pathways for that to happen? And if not, how can I be proactive in helping create those? Hopefully there will be someone at some level of the leadership structure above me who is approachable and wants to hear the feedback for improving.
Very interesting. I have one follow-up question. You say people have to figure out what they want and what the ask is. For some people, it can be very difficult to articulate exactly what they're looking for. Do you have any advice for people who have difficulty articulating what they need or what they want?
It's a great point. And boy, sometimes it's not easy. You know, when's the last time that you ask someone you care about what they want for dinner? Like someone who's living in your house, and you say, what do you want for dinner? And they say, I don't know. Well, I don't want Chinese food, and I don't want pizza, and I don't really want tacos, and God help me if we have roast beef again. And you're like, well, great, that's what you don't want. But what do you want? Because I can't make what it is you want if I don't know what you're in the mood for. Right? So when we're in this position of not knowing what we want, it's easy to get stuck in the don'ts. Well, I don't want this, and I don't want that, and I don't like how the organization is doing this, and I don't find this to be helpful. That's all valid. That's all incredibly reasonable, because then when you start to invite yourself to phrase it over into the affirmative of then what do I want, it can help to structure the ask, because it's easy to tell folks what you don't like. So if you find yourself using the words don't a lot in your own self-talk, it might be helpful to then put it into, okay, and what do I want? And that might be a place of being able to generate more behaviorally specific requests when you know what it is you actually do want.
Following a traumatic event, you discuss how important it is for those who are affected to connect with loved ones or people they trust. Can you discuss what this looks like in the world we're in now with the pandemic? Do virtual connections have the same effectiveness as in-person connections?
Boy, is this a timely question and a topic for us to think about. Human beings are social. By our very nature and design, being social and being part of a group is a survival-related thing for humans. We are constantly scanning our social environments for safety cues, because if I am safe in a group, I will survive in a group. Some nice work that's done by another author of the Culture Code, for those of you who are interested, nice work. But as we look for this, summarized in that book, as we look for safety cues, and we are social and we are humans looking for a sense of belonging and safety, we're looking for trust, and critical events have broken that trust. So we really need those connections to reaffirm safety. And it's really, really difficult to get those cues conveyed in non-face-to-face environments. So right now, during a pandemic, when we are not connecting with family, friends, and other loved ones outside of our pod, we're in a place of having compromised access to safety cues and to healing. So even the growing availability of things, you know, like the vaccines, are making it much more possible for us to connect. There's still people who are living and working in very different conditions from those that they knew pre-pandemic. And the connections that we have virtually, as part of your follow-up question, are better than nothing, right? We can still see people's faces, see their expressions. And the challenge can be that I'm trying to, as a social animal, make eye contact with a screen and with a point in my focal range that doesn't actually exist with another person on the other side. And it might be the case that when I'm talking to you on a camera and I want you to experience that I'm really talking to you, I have to look at the camera and only at the camera for you to have the experience I'm making eye contact with you. And then the minute that I want to read your cues to see if you're responding to me like I'm hoping you are, I have to break eye contact and look over on the screen to where you actually are. And now it looks like I've looked away. So as you're talking, I'm no longer looking at you because I'm sending a different visual cue, even though I'm trying to see your face. So these slight changes in how we interact as people aren't ones that we are necessarily overtly compensating for and get coded as disrespects or as lack of attention or as contemptuousness or as an eye roll, when in fact, I'm just trying to find you on my screen. So it challenges us on a subtle level that we're not always aware of, and yet it's better than nothing. So it's a tricky place we're in right now. And as we find our quote new normal and step in and out of it post-pandemic, it'll be curious observational times for us to see how humans continue to interact socially and what that means for us.
And this is especially difficult when you're not even aware that you're interpreting things as disrespect.
It's hard. It's really hard for people.
Can an organization help an employee who does not have loved ones or friends to support? What is the organization's responsibility to supply this help?
So there's two parts there I'm hearing. One is that can an organization help? And then the other part of that is, does the organization actually have a responsibility to supply this help? So the first one's the easy part. So let's go for that. Can an organization help? Yeah, absolutely. There's all sorts of resources that an organization might be able to choose to put forward, especially for those who don't have social supports outside of the organization. So things like employee assistance plans, offers of relocations or transfers to areas where maybe someone does have family, friends, or support networks, so they aren't so isolated. Those are certainly things that employers could choose to do. And then as far as what's the organization's responsibility or obligation to supply this help, that really starts to get into a moral and ethical kind of issue, doesn't it? Around what is my culpability for the damage and who is accountable for the repair of that damage? And does that accountability extend into mental wellness and physical well-being? And those are complex and complicated issues that have personal and professional anchor points, as well as some potential precedent that's growing in case law around different issues of critical events, of just who is responsible for what to what degree. So that is a very complicated question, one that we probably won't be able to get fully responded to in this venue, but it's worth all of our thought and consideration in a very mindful way of really what is our responsibility. Our responsibility financially, our responsibility legally, our responsibility ethically and morally as humans. What does that look like for us? And what kind of an organization do we want to be? And what kind of leadership do we want to set by example of how we handle these things? So it's a really interesting question. Thank you.
How does an organization handle recovering from a traumatic event if most of the workforce is working virtually? For instance, how does a leader show that they are present in a virtual environment? How do employees connect with other employees?
That's a great question. You know, we were just talking about how important it is to be face-to-face, and the reality is that we can't be right now in so many cases. If we were still face-to-face in the same work environment, it's really easy for leadership to step out of offices and to do connection rounds, if you will. Instead of like a hospital physician doing rounds with medical students to do cases and to check in on patients, leadership can do leadership rounds and walk around into different workplaces and have conversations with people, water cooler moments, etc. When we're not physically present to be able to do that, we need to be more creative. So things like virtual office hours, I open up my door. I put it out there to everybody that I will be in this meeting, right? Whether it is a Zoom or a Teams or whatever product you're using for virtual connections, I sign into the space and I log on and I turn my camera on and I'm there. And anybody who wants to drop in and join and have a conversation, this is my way of stepping out of my office or at least opening up my office door, that I'm available for drop-in sessions and smaller connections with people who want to have a more directed one-on-one kind of conversation. I can hold regularly scheduled town halls or larger group forums if people are interested in that, to have the opportunity to have bigger conversations. I can invite myself if I am a high enough leader, or certainly have the conversation laterally with respect to joining other departments, teams, work groups, planning sessions and meetings. So perhaps instead of opening up my door and seeing if anybody's willing to come in through my door, I might go out and knock on other people's doors. I know that they meet at this date, at this time, this is their staff meeting. Maybe I can ask to be on their agenda and just have a listening session. Be more visible and more present, especially if those are work groups that are still challenged by or suffering from the aftermath and the fallout of some disillusionment, perhaps post-event. If I'm in a meeting and it's a larger meeting, be brave, be bold, and turn on your camera. Show people that you're there. It is remarkable the difference that one person turning a camera on can do to allow other people to step forward and do the same, so that we can still get, for people who are sighted, still get that visual connection. For those of us who are visually impaired, keep the microphone on so that folks can hear what it is that you're saying and to be able to make that connection. The Culture Code, I mentioned it before, it's a book by Daniel Coyle. Has a lot of information and summary of the research and the literature on safety and vulnerability and leadership by example, of your willingness as a leader to say, here I am, maybe I'm struggling, maybe I need some assistance, and here's what I could use help with, gives other people that same permission. And we constantly send out those cues as part of the drumbeat of our organization's culture. Where am I finding new drums to beat upon, to send messages when I don't have the ability to just walk down the hall, right? So we take what we've got and we need to be creative with it.
You talk about permission structures. That can sometimes sound like you need explicit permission to do something. What is it in this context? Is it just helping to make it easier to do things?
Exactly. So it's not necessarily a clearance, if you will, and an overt bit of permission, but allowing other people the opportunity to follow your example. And if you set an example that says, I'm here, I'm open, I'm willing, and here's some of my challenge around what has happened, then that lets people know that they're safe to do the same. And that it's not an environment that you're creating as a leader that is one of being judged, but one rather that you're trying to set an example of psychological safety, so that people are able to grant themselves the permission to step forward and join you in that same safe space.
It all comes back to safety, social safety.
Right. And when we are post-event and in critical places and feeling disillusioned following breaches to our trust, we're really struggling with safety issues. And it's about establishing that safety again so that we can trust again and keep moving forward.
Can you elaborate on why transparency is critical during the post-event recovery phase and how employees can approach an employer if they feel there's a lack of transparency?
Absolutely. So transparency is part of building trust again. People wonder what it is that's not being said if they can't see and hear their leaders on a regular basis. And in the absence of information, the human brain makes stuff up. We fill in the gaps. We start telling ourselves stories. We want to have purpose, sense, meaning, worth, value in the events that happen in our lives. And when we don't have information supplied, we'll make it up to fill in those gaps. And unfortunately, we often get it wrong. So transparency in leadership and transparency in process is about reducing the likelihood that someone has to make up a story to create sense, purpose, meaning, worth, and value around events. So we are our brains are sense-making organs, right? We try to make sense of our world based upon this thing that lives in my head and how it organizes information. And my head is going to tell me that it's right all the time, even when it's not. And transparency from leadership makes it less likely that my head's going to fill it in wrong. It's about being vulnerable. It's about being open so that people can see that, yes, I am struggling too. And yes, I care about this organization. I care about you. I'm less likely to betray you if I am being transparent, because betrayal happens in the shadows and with secrets. And if I am being transparent, then there are no shadows and there are no secrets. And you can take me at my face value and at my front page worth. And in time, hopefully rebuild some of that trust. Transparency is critical for that foundation.
Transparency sounds great, but what does it mean to be transparent, and how much transparency is appropriate? And is there too much transparency?
Well, you know, that's interesting because, you know, there's like the little catchphrase TMI, too much information, right, is part of our culture for a reason. That's perhaps the little moment where we try to make light of the fact that, whoa, that's too much information. That's too much transparency. I didn't need to know that. There certainly are legal limits around information sharing, privacy law. If there's an active investigation that's ongoing and compromising an evidentiary base, would happen by being too transparent, we've got to be careful. So there are possibilities around privacy law, human resource actions, fair information sharing laws around what we can and can't say that could be too transparent. The piece around transparency is more about how transparent are you with being a human and showing your process, as opposed to being transparent around content, unless it is content that can be shared because you have no potential downstream negative consequences of sharing that information with people that would compromise their safety otherwise. So it's a balance point. When we were talking about being transparent, I was meaning more in the sense of here I am. It is a radical approach to authenticity. I am radically authentic in front of you in this moment. And I'm not going to pull my punches with respect to being a human. And I hope that you won't either. That's the kind of transparency that I was referring to. So thank you for the opportunity to clarify.
Of course. Thank you for talking about transparency. I want to turn to a little different topic. In other work, you talk about a trauma-informed approach and how it is vital that an organization realizes, recognizes, responds, and resists trauma or re-traumatization. Can you discuss how this may be difficult given the mental health stigma that is present within certain organizations?
Absolutely. And anything we can do to wear down that unfortunate stigma is deeply appreciated for all people. When we talk about being trauma-informed, it doesn't necessarily mean being an expert in trauma recovery. The workplace probably doesn't need and probably shouldn't, in all honesty, become a big unending therapy session, right? So being trauma-informed isn't necessarily about providing mental health services to all employees in real time at all times, right? That's not where we want to go with being trauma-informed. I think perhaps maybe an analogy might be helpful in understanding what that would look like as a trauma-informed organization. Let's imagine that you're an electrician, okay? And you have a widget, right? A little electric thing that you have purchased. Now, you're a clever researcher. You are a clever consumer, and you have gone out and gathered every single bit of information about widgets that's possible to collect. And you have made your decision to buy the best widget that is possibly out there that you can get. And you order your widget and it arrives, ding dong. And you get your little text at the same time saying your package has been delivered, and that's pretty cool. And you run outside and you get your box, and here's your widget, the magic widget you've been waiting for. You set up your camera, do a little selfie as you unbox your widget so you can post that for your friends and see your unboxing video. And here it is, the best widget you've ever had. And because you're a smart and good consumer, you plug your made for the 110 world widget into the 110 wall outlet that exists here in the United States. So you plug it in, and because you're smart and clever and wonderful, and it's the best widget ever, your widget is working fabulously. You plugged your 110 widget into the 110 wall outlet and all is good. Trauma is like taking that 110 widget overseas and attempting to plug it into 220 wall outlets. Now, the plugs are not actually compatible, but suspend disbelief with me for a moment and assume that they might be, right? So now you've got this widget that you're so proud of and so in love with, and it's working great, and you forget that you're not back home, and you attempt to plug your 110 widget into the 220 wall outlet. And what happens is that your 110 widget is going to work really, really well, really, really quickly for an exceedingly short period of time. And then it's going to blow, right? You're going to have a mess of molten plastic and melted widget and fused wires, and it's not going to be pretty. So now, electrician that you are and good consumer that you are, you're going to have to figure out how to repair your widget and up armor your widget to operate in the 220 world. You're going to have to get adapters and circuit breakers and resistors, capacitors, heavier gauged wire, a soldering iron, and you're going to get a schematic and a diagram, and you're going to rewire your widget so that it can operate in the 220 world. And now, because you are clever, you have fixed your widget and you can plug it into the 220 wall outlet, and lo and behold, the world's best widget is working again. Congratulations. And now you go back home. And now you take your up-armored 220 compatible widget back to the 110 world and attempt to plug it in and have it work in the 110 world. And it doesn't. There's not enough juice to make it go. So you have two broad brushstroke options, right? You can rewire your widget again and de-armor it, right? Stand it down so that it can operate in 110, or you can go around looking for 220 in the 110 world, trying to find ways to get enough juice to make it go. And understanding that analogy and applying it to people and processes and organizations is about being trauma-informed. Right? Humans are pretty much the same as that little widget. We are able to operate effectively in the 110 world, whatever that 110 world is for us. We know how to cope. We know how to compensate. We know how to handle the stresses of our lives. And then trauma, a critical event, is about plugging us into 220. We work really, really well, really, really quickly for a very short period of time. And then we fall into that disillusionment phase, and it's time to up armor if we're going to keep going. So we have to figure out what it is we're going to do to compensate and fix ourselves so that we can still operate in that post-critical event world. And we're still trying to survive in the 220 world when it could happen again. When we get out far enough, it's like saying, how much of that up armoring are you willing to let go of? How many of your survival-related skills can you stop using? Or do you keep looking for 220 in your daily life? Are you looking for threat all the time still? Are you engaging in behaviors that give you that 220 kick again? Are you picking fights? Are you drinking and driving? Are you, as one of the people it was my privilege to work with, a true pleasure, mentioned that he surfed his motorcycle so that he could get enough adrenaline back in his system to make it go, right? So he could feel something again. So we can see 220 behaviors in the 110 world. And if we as an organization aren't understanding those and have practices for what we're going to do about them, we might not be particularly trauma-informed. Right? So being trauma-informed is understanding what trauma does to people and how it behaviorally manifests afterwards, and what we can do as an organization to support the process of people being effective in the 110 world once again.
Thank you for that analogy, too.
That definitely helps, because I know a lot of talk about trauma is not particularly helpful. And sometimes it talks about people who are traumatized as being defective or bad, or there's something wrong. But the way you describe it is that it's you're really moving from one state to another to survive. So I like that analogy a lot.
Yeah. Feel free to share it.
Is it copyrighted?
Maybe I should copyright it. Yeah. This is something that was a pleasure to get to use with veterans in post-traumatic stress disorder symptom management classes. It was born real time in the moment when I was a baby, brand new psychologist, and has been a very solid piece of sharing that has been part of what we do for the last 20 plus years in our program. So thank you. I'm glad you like it.
Thank you all for listening, and a big thank you to our speaker, Lynn Van Mail. Don't miss out on new products from the Threat Lab and announcements about the 2021 Summit. Sign up for a distribution list at dodhra.threatlab@mail.mil. All of our products are free, so you don't need a promo code. Thank you again, Lynn, for all of your help and taking your time to talk with us about this topic.
Thank you very much for the opportunity and invitation. Very much appreciate what you're doing at the Threat Lab. Thank you.